Well, hi everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is.
My name is John Martin Fisher, and I'm a professor in the philosophy department at the University of California, Riverside.
And in fact, John, you are correctly titled Distinguished Professor, and indeed you are a distinguished professor with a lowercase as well as an uppercase D. And it's great to see you after many years. So, John, to kick things off, I'd like to ask what's currently dynamizing, retarding, concerning, preoccupying, interesting you?
Pretty simple answer. Recently, there's been a big book published by a famous Stanford neurobiologist. Robert Sapolsky is his name. He wrote a book called "Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers," and he's written on primates, higher primates, but his recent book is called "Determined," and it is a long book, and it lays out ways in which he thinks all our human choices and actions are determined by our past, our genetics, our environmental influences, and so forth. He concludes there is no free will, there is no moral responsibility. Now, it's gotten a lot of attention. It's throughout the Anglo-American world, at least, perhaps also in Europe. It's been reviewed in the Times Literary Supplement, in the Atlantic, in the New Yorker, various philosophical journals. Although, those are pretty slow to get on board sometimes. But I wrote an extended review in the Notre Dame Philosophical Reviews, which is online, and your listeners are welcome to Google that. But so I disagree with the conclusion, but also with many of the arguments. And I don't think the issues about free will and moral responsibility are primarily scientific issues. They're human issues, they're philosophical and theological, but they're not necessarily scientific. So that's what's happened is I've written a number of pieces, some of which are in public venues like the Los Angeles Times, and I've been addressing the neuroscience and the philosophy, and it's got me really energized beginning a book on this subject. So that's my current preoccupation.
I can see why. And of course, free will is something that you've been writing about since time immemorial.
Well, people, certainly human beings, have been worried about it since maybe before Aristotle's famous discussion of the sea battle argument, the fatalist argument that he attributes to the sophists. And throughout the Middle Ages, questions about God and free will, and into the modern times with causal determinism, science and free will. So, even though I'm not quite that old, ever since I started my thinking about this professionally, that's been my main issue, free will and moral responsibility. Sometimes I think, the scientists, they're brilliant and they have insights, but they need to stay in their lane, just like I need to stay in my lane. And I've sometimes reflected. As I said, Robert Sapolsky wrote a well-regarded, well-known book called "Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers." What if I wrote a book called "Why Zebras Do In Fact Get Ulcers"? That would not be staying in my lane. And when he writes a book called, "Determined: Why We Have No Free Will" or something like that, it's just as outrageous in my view as it would be if I pontificated on neuroscience. So, I've been thinking about these issues for a long time. And I think the recent almost flip, but certainly glib books by not just Sapolsky, but Sam Harris and other neuroscientists have gotten under my skin.
John, it's good to hear someone defending what they do and criticizing others for stepping in. which happens all the time, of course. Enormous pronouncements, utterly Olympian, are made about all manner of things by intellectuals. And of course, some of that can come from their publishers and their agents urging them on to speak in ways that everybody will understand and to provide a comprehensive theory of everything, right? Which is not to say Sapolsky doesn't believe what he says. It's just to say there are some interesting conditions of existence for this sort of thing, which might also explain why it's gotten so much attention. So, and you've contributed to that attention, in fact. And good on you for entering into the lists in the LA Times and elsewhere. Why do you think this crossing of the lanes has attracted so much interest in public culture?
Let's pause for just a second. Okay, let's pause. Oh, I see. Yeah, that's a great question. And I think we all do or should welcome interdisciplinary collaboration. And certainly issues about free will and responsibility are not just the domain of philosophy or even those of us who do Anglo-American analytic philosophy, where our focus is somewhat narrow. I think that the public is interested because these are existential questions. They're questions that we human beings have simply because we exist as human beings. We deliberate, we make choices, and we act, and many of us, certainly most of us, believe we have to take responsibility for the consequences. Another thing that's going on, unfortunately, is terrible, terrible events throughout the world, which involve people acting very badly. You have Putin, directing a horrendous, horrendous war against the Ukraine with civilians dying, and it's just horrible what's happening. You have both Hamas and, in my view, Israel engaging in behavior that's cruel, that's totally that's vicious, that's evil, at best insensitive and inhumane. And these are just two examples, of very, very visible, very disturbing events in our world. You don't have to pick large-scale events. You have all the terrible killings in the United States with our crazy gun culture, rapes, murders. And it's natural as human beings for us to be angry, to be morally angry, to be angry because of these moral transgressions, these horrible moral transgressions. And yet the scientists and some philosophers are arguing that this is all unjustified, that people aren't acting from their own free will, and even if their behavior seems to be morally horrible, we ought to reflect. And we when we see, we should take a more humane attitude. To me, this is just outrageous. I just think it's humanly so disturbing that I don't think that these theorists should get away with it. Let me put it that way. So anyway, to answer your question, to reiterate, these are human questions.
Yes.
All of us have these questions, and we see around us terrible events. And so any discussion of moral responsibility engages us, I think.
And so it's natural that providing the promise of a scientific answer to these things will be attractive because, as you say, it engages existential questions. That also raises an issue for me, John, of what should be the role of philosophy. And I ask you this in particular in the context of what you were referring to earlier, the Anglo-American analytic tradition, which often takes a lot of distance from classic issues of moral, social, political philosophy, political theory, and so on, and actually often aligns itself with ideas of neuroscience. So
Yes.
Could you help us out with that dilemma or my dilemma?
Great, great points. And I agree with your first point that many people are attracted to the scientific perspective because it seems empirical, it is empirical, it seems to be objective, and it would be great if we could detach ourselves from the basic disagreements that we have about these issues and rely on something objective, something clear-cut. Unfortunately, that turns to out to be an illusory hope, because not because the perspective is somehow defective or faulty, but just because it doesn't apply here, or at least can't be dispositive here. Science is useful and helpful in so many ways, but it can't resolve some questions that involve human judgment and value. Analytic philosophy increasingly is allowing for empirically informed inquiry. We have been justly criticized for just operating from an armchair, and so now many philosophers are trying to embed their work within broader empirical, so social science and even natural science perspectives, but also some of us think it's very important, though not all of us, unfortunately, it's very important to engage with broader human concerns. I think, Toby, one of the things you would be quite interested in is this movement called analytic existentialism. And it basically is a group of us, because I'm one of the contemporary analytic philosophers who look at some of the issues that traditionally were the domain only of existentialists. So free will, but death, meaning in life, you know, what is the meaning of life, immortality. These are questions perhaps that analytic philosophers didn't traditionally focus on. They were more narrowly concerned with the meanings of words and language and logic. But now there is this whole group called analytic existentialists. And so I think there's hope for analytic philosophy. And the great thing about what we can offer is we do have a methodology that's rigorous and maybe can be helpful within the broader context.
Of these issues. And actually, without knowing it was called analytic existentialism, I have read quite a lot of your work on those topics. I just haven't read it
Interesting.
in that light. And I wonder if you could expound for a little bit on this very testy, inexorably unpleasant for many of us, but inevitable question, the D word, death.
Oh, yes. Quickly, some of the most well-known contributors to analytic existentialism, excuse me, analytic existentialism, are Thomas Nagel, the New York University emeritus philosopher, and Bernard Williams, now passed away, but Oxford philosopher and University of California, Berkeley, Susan Wolf, and others. And they, appropriately enough, their main concern has been death, at least as they relate to existential questions. Thomas Nagel wrote a famous article called Death about 50 years ago, published about 50 years ago, that's really elicited all sorts of interesting responses and developments. Bernard Williams famously wrote about the play by the Czech playwright Čapek, Karel Čapek, made into an opera by Leo Janáček. It was about whether death is bad and whether we would choose immortality or living forever. The D word, again, it's an existential question. We all wonder, I'm sure, going back to the earliest human beings, they saw animals that stopped functioning, their bodies stopped moving. They noticed that their fellow human beings had a similar fate, and they wondered what's going on as they're dying, what happens afterwards, is there consciousness, is there an afterlife? And of course, some of the questions have led to religious beliefs, either in certain traditions, reincarnation, the Buddhist tradition, for instance, or some Buddhist traditions, Hinduism. But in the Judeo-Christian tradition, particularly the Christian tradition, an afterlife, heaven, hell, other realms, purgatory, limbo. And the whole idea there is, gives you some kind of explanation, something you could say to hang your hat on, and it can be comforting. That's one of the reasons why
Yes.
religion, I think, is so prevalent and long-lasting. Maybe we'll end up in a good place, but in any case, we won't go out of existence. I think that one of the most interesting threads in this long-lasting conversation is about the secular view of death. And on that view, we go out of existence completely when our body stops functioning. When we die, there's no afterlife, there's no further consciousness. We just go out of existence. And the question, going back to the Greeks, Epicurus, is how can that be a bad thing for us? How can that be a bad thing for the individual who dies? Because she will no longer suffer. They will no longer exist at all to be harmed. So how could that possibly be bad? And that's really, Thomas Nagel kind of vitalized those issues going back to Epicurus. He vitalized those issues, and there's a huge contemporary debate about whether we should, whether death can be bad for the individual, whether it harms the individual, and what our attitude should be. Should we fear our deaths in the future? So that right, those are just some, to scratch the surface, some of the
Oh, some of
concerns
the
and
issues. Yes, thank you. And John, touching on some of the questions you raised there, you've also written a lot about religion.
yes.
And this is something that clearly has long been a core issue in pop philosophy and philosophy. But again, I would have thought not so friendly or not so interesting to analytic philosophers.
Right.
Dorothy, would
That's
that be
very
right?
interesting. Sorry. It is right as a historic matter, but what happened is, this is very interesting. In the 1970s, analytic philosophy in the United States changed significantly. It used to be a very abstract discipline, and in ethics, we discussed the meaning of ethical terms and the logic of ethical judgments. But then there was the war in Vietnam, and that precipitated the founding by Thomas Nagel and John Rawls and Judith Jarvis Thompson and other major philosophical figures of a journal called Philosophy and Public Affairs. It was published by Princeton Press. And it published a number of articles that dealt not with so much the abstract issues, but substantive ethical and political issues. Whether, what are war crimes, whether the war was justified, but also other applied issues like abortion and affirmative action. And so that was one of the ways in which philosophy changed. Moving away from this more abstract orientation to a more practical orientation. But another way we changed was we took not just ethics, but aesthetics, and in particular, philosophy of religion and theology seriously. And it became now okay, and indeed respectable to apply analytic methods to philosophy of religion, or sorry, to religion. And there, an important movement, development was the founding of another journal. This is called Faith and Philosophy. And there were major, well-respected analytic philosophers who participated in the journal and also in making philosophy of religion safe or respectable to analytic philosophers. One is Alvin Plantinga, a Notre Dame philosopher, recently won the Templeton Prize. and also Robert Adams and Marilyn Adams, famous UCLA professors, and others. So you're quite right traditionally, but I'd say in the last 50 years, things have changed. And I think it has been a mixed blessing because I think it's good to be rigorous about these issues. I think sometimes there's an excessive rigor because people feel they have a chip on their shoulder and they want to prove that they're, as it were, more rigorous than thou, or at least as rigorous as other philosophers. And that produces some technical literature that I think is unfortunate.
And Prof. John, one of the things that you've written about in this context, amongst these social issues you've mentioned, is abortion. And
Yes.
you've done so with reference to the violin case and the
Yeah.
cabin case, if I can use those terms.
Right.
Many listeners may not be familiar with those questions or those models and how you respond to them, because you have an interesting way of coming down, if I can give a spoiler alert, in support of the case for abortion under certain circumstances without accepting the violin explanation or justification.
Right. Very good. You know, one thing, if I may say so, is a little bit, it's striking, but a little depressing that when I started teaching a course on contemporary moral issues at the beginning of my career, which would have been more than 40 years ago at Yale University, discussed abortion. And now it's still a contemporary moral issue. So that's something that really hasn't gone away. And I think, I mean, it's a difficult philosophically. I mean, one of the problems is, again, it's a deeply emotional issue for people. And it's also theologically charged or charged from a religious point of view, but also philosophically very deeply interesting, actually, and difficult. And one of the reasons is it goes to the issue of what makes us persons, what not so much just human beings, but human persons with a right to life. And that's something that's deeply controversial. It's not even straightforward when we become a live human being. I mean, I think that's also contentious, but even more difficult is which live human beings are actually already persons, have serious rights to life. And so there's that question. And a very conservative position would be, well, it's at the fertilization of the egg. The zygote is already a person, or perhaps an implanted embryo. That's a person. Of course, you know, you get many less conservative and more so-called liberal positions, according to which the individual doesn't become a person maybe until the second trimester of pregnancy, etc. But now there's also a different set of questions about what the pregnant woman's rights are over her body. Presumably we have autonomy and privacy rights, and that would seem to entail that a woman has the right to control what happens in and to her body. Now, how do these relate to each other? That's really where the philosophical problems come in. And, you know, you see it now in various in Supreme Court verdicts here or decisions here in the United States, and also the recent Alabama State Supreme Court decision about IVF. In which they said the embryo, even before implantation, is, as they said, a child, by which they meant a person with a right to continued existence. So, big problems. Judith Thompson, the MIT philosopher, famous, wonderful woman philosopher, came up with an example in which she said, okay, you might think that the right to life, let's just assume the fetus at an early stage has the right to life. That's controversial, but let's assume it for the sake of the argument. You might think The right to life is more important than all other rights, including the right to of the mother to control what happens in and to her body. But that's not true, Judith Thompson said. So even if the fetus is a person, doesn't follow that abortion is impermissible. She had the example of the violinist. You find yourself hooked up. You just wake up one day and you've been kidnapped in your sleep, and without your consent, you've been hooked up to a famous violinist. This violinist needs the use of your organs, let's say your kidney, because there is no transplant available, or the individual is not capable of taking a transplant, and they have some disorder, some disease, and it will go away in 9 months, but they need to use your kidney. You're the only one available for 9 months. That's the hypothetical scenario. And what Thompson says is, yes, this is an innocent person, this violinist, with a serious right to life. But you have the right to unplug yourself if you wish. You don't have to participate in helping the violinist, even though they have a right to life, because you have a right to control your body. And so she inferred that that's the case with the abortion too. I agree with her conclusion. I agree that philosophically speaking, we can argue that even if the fetus is considered a person, abortion is permissible. But the way I would argue, it's perhaps philosophically a long story, but let me just say the bottom line is, in as opposed to the violinist case, in the case, let's say, of a rape, an unconsented to pregnancy, the woman has been violated, her body has been damaged, and now, unlike in the fetus, the violinist case, she is being asked to take to term an organism, an individual, let's say a person who has her genetics, her DNA fused with that of her rapist or her violator. And that's something that's fundamentally different from the case of the violinist. But so I think we don't extrapolate from the violinist case, but we can still see that someone's right to control her body and her reproductive rights, her ownership of her own genetics should trump and can trump an individual's personhood. In any case, that was a long answer. And I think the short answer is the philosophical conflict is between personhood and autonomy. And even though you might think personhood is the most important hegemonic issue, it's not, when you reflect on it, it doesn't necessarily seem to be the case. A woman's right to control her reproductive life might well be more important.
It's an interesting one when we think about limit cases. For example, the fact that there may be many people in favor of abortion who are opposed to the death penalty, and many people in favor of the death penalty who are opposed to abortion. And this also makes me think about less consequential limit cases, but interesting ones. And I say interesting, obviously, we're having this conversation as men, and our subjectivities, our identities, put us in particular relationship to these debates. But I used to find when I lived in California, a happy time in many ways for me, and I was fortunate enough to be your colleague, John, at the same university, when I would see signs in bars saying things like, if when pregnant, smoking causes damage to the unborn, or with reference to the use of alcohol, drinking alcohol may cause damage to the unborn. This seems to be unexceptional to many people, but doesn't it run counter to the notion that the fetus is in the woman, but it is still part of her body and she has total control over it? These were not legal preventions of the woman's action, but they were very strong public condemnations of potential action in places where contravention of those imprecations would be common, or at least
Right.
potentially so.
Yeah, these excellent points, and they raise some of the subtleties of the political but also philosophical debates. Right, you have people who are, they say they're strongly pro-life, and yet they don't seem to care about the individual once they're born. They don't believe in providing basic health care and food
Right.
and shelter.
Right.
They also are in favor of the death penalty, which again seems in conflict with their belief in the sanctity of human life. I think what they're going to argue, I don't think it's entirely easy to resolve that tension, but I know they will say that killing the fetus is kill. I mean, if you assume they're a person, now that's totally controversial. I don't agree with that at the early stages of pregnancy. But if they are a person, as these people, the pro-lifers, tend to believe, they're an innocent person, a morally innocent person. But the capital punishment applies to individuals who have contravened some very serious legal and moral principles, so or rules. So they're not innocent. So that's what they would say. The culture of life applies to innocent human beings. Now, if the fetus is, as it were, threatening the mother's life, the continuing development of the fetus is threatening the woman's life, sometimes the pro-lifers will make an exception there. They'll say it's not really innocent. But some people won't even make that exception and say they're morally innocent. They haven't made a choice to put someone else's life in jeopardy. But so there are ways of making it consistent, but it's complicated. And I think the more enlightened pro-lifers would say about services for children once the individual is born, that that's very important, that we should support adoption, that we should support basic medical care. At least the enlightened ones will say that. And I think the idea that certain kinds of behavior like drug use, alcohol, smoking would affect the unborn individual and therefore affect their lives once they are indisputably persons. I think that's the idea of protecting individuals from harm by others. So there's some kinds of behavior that are self-regarding and some that are other regarding. And the idea is, even though the fetus is in the mother's, in the pregnant woman's body, if you think it's a person, then harming it is harming someone else. And even if you don't think it's yet a person, so maybe you're a liberal, very progressive and pro-choice, you still could say, even though that individual is not yet a person, if you smoke or you use alcohol, that will damage the individual down the road. And that, you know, we as liberals don't believe that you could go around harming other persons. So I think you can, you do some philosophical dance, some kind of philosophical choreography. Sometimes it seems a little too elaborate, but sometimes it's fairly simple, and you can make some of these ideas compatible with each other.
Thank you, John. That was a great philosophical dance. And I mean that positively. I've got two more questions for you, Prof, if I may, and then I'd like to throw it to you to add anything you may wish to what we've discussed. Does that sound okay as a way of drawing things to a
Absolutely.
conclusion? So the first question is related to the fact that almost every day I read about some clean-shaven white man with vast amounts of money who wants to live forever and who is dedicating his ill or well-gotten Silicon Valley resources towards this. You directed a very well-known project somewhat related to this, but perhaps at a more philosophical level, the Immortality Project. I wonder if you could tell us about the project and where immortality resides for you in the light of these men who do not wish to die.
Well, you're absolutely right that many of the most salient individuals who are promoting research into longevity and even immortality are rich white men. Elon Musk is one, and there are various Silicon Valley billionaires. What's interesting is people like Musk and Jeff Bezos are trying to go into space, or they're founding companies that support these that have rocket ships. And one of the ideas about immortality is somehow we'll be able to colonize other planets, and some of the environmental pressures we can avoid that way. I don't know if that's, I think part of it's just ego, but they are in search of immortality. And it's not surprising because their lives are so good. We know money can't buy happiness. It's not a sufficient condition for living well, flourishing, happy, but it sure helps. And in any context, it seems that people who live those kinds of lives just want more and more, whereas people who struggle in poverty or physical impairment or living in dirty environments, we're less concerned or are less concerned. I mean, I consider myself very lucky and privileged. Okay. I will say that even though it seems to be the domain of the very wealthy, many, many human beings, no matter what their social and economic status, yearn for longer life. And you can see that in just the so-called anti-aging medicine movement and various ways, even cosmetically, to look younger. In any case, it is one of the, I'd say, two forces in human nature that go in opposite directions. One is the desire to live forever, and the other one is a kind of revulsion against it. So, the Immortality Project, it was a $5.2 million project funded by the John Templeton Foundation. It was from 2012 to 2015, so it's been over now for about 9 years. And what we did was we funded, through competitions, research in philosophy, theology, and science. What were the scientific project? Many of them dealt with near-death experiences and trying to understand them. And there were other empirical projects, like studying different people's views about the afterlife, maybe comparing Western and Asian and African views. And I thought it was a really rewarding project to be part of. And we have a web page, and I can provide you and perhaps your listeners with that web page, that URL, which lists the research that came out of that project. And there are more than 100 articles and books and videos. And in fact, there was a great project headquartered right there in Barcelona by a group that is involved in immersive AI, immersive artificial intelligence, and actually a little, that is what they use, but a little bit more accurate, immersive virtual reality. They use virtual reality to simulate a near-death experience, and they ask people about their reactions and try and figure out whether they're the same as in a genuine, non-simulated one. But also, they're involved in a whole set of interesting projects using virtual reality. So, it ended up with a lot of interesting research. But in the sciences, it takes perhaps a long time for some of the projects to really reach fruition. And I'm still tracking those.
Really, really interesting. Thank you very much, John, for explaining that and for situating the search for immortality more generally. My last question before throwing to you to conclude, if I may, is something that relates to your, I was going to say indoctrinating me, sorry, I meant educating me about analytic existentialism. And it's to ask you what is a thorny and perhaps boring question, and many philosophers just go, ugh, if I asked about it, which is the relationship between so-called analytic and so-called continental philosophy. How are things going? Are white people still turning red and shouting, or are they calm and enjoying it? And how does it relate to including more perspectives from the global south in terms of what counts as philosophy?
Yeah, those are excellent questions, and I've always been fascinated by them because I did do my undergraduate and graduate work at departments that were heavily analytic. But then my first job was at Yale University, where the philosophy department at that point was notoriously polarized, but it had a whole wing or faction that did continental or European
Oh,
philosophy,
I didn't know
but
that.
also a smaller group that did analytic philosophy, and they were kind of at each other's throats. And when I got to UC Riverside, there were actually some fights. There was a prominent Nietzsche scholar whom you probably knew, Bernd Magnus, and then he had disagreements with some of the analytic folks. And we've always, by the way, had, ever since Bernd, an excellent senior Nietzsche scholar, so we were noted for that. I think what's happened, I mean, if you look at Yale and you look at UCR, you'll see that there's much more of a detente. I'm not sure. We definitely are not fighting so openly as it were, vigorously or virulently, but we're not at the point where we're totally in peaceful, happy times. It's somewhere in between. But I think the idea is, at a place like Yale, or in particular UC Riverside, we talk to each other. We recognize we have some similar interests in death, immortality. We had a very a good Heidegger scholar, Mark Rothall, who unfortunately we lost to Oxford. He has a chair now in European philosophy at Oxford. But he used to sit in on my seminars on death, and he would offer perspectives on Heidegger's views on death, and we still correspond. And I think that's just one example of ways in which we find common ground and maybe slightly different perspectives on those questions, and we benefit from each other. So I would say there's real progress. But it's, I mean, but I think it's also true that when resources are scarce, as they are now in academics and in particular in the humanities, there will be disagreements about at the margin whom to hire, what kind of position to hire.
Yes.
And then even when we're hiring, there may be disagreements about the methodology we want to see, whether it be more, so to speak, literary or, so to speak, analytic. But it's an excellent question. I think we've made progress, but we're not to the promised land, so to speak. And finally, about the South, the global South, very interesting because there are now places throughout in Mexico at UNAM and also South America where people are very interested in analytic philosophy. I mean,
Yes.
it's truly been focused on Marx and some of the European philosophers. But there's a place called the University of the Andes, and they have a real strength in free will studies and analytic free will studies. And they got a different Templeton Foundation grant to support for 3 years research, collaborative research between American philosophers and indigenous philosophers in Peru. And there's still, they founded a journal. And so free will is a focal point where there is some interesting collaboration and integration of the global South in the broader conversation. I should mention in particular Manuel Vargas, who is a philosopher at UC San Diego, and he was involved in the leadership of that Templeton project, and he still has connections And we're developing more and more, what's the word, inclusion of the global South in our canon. I just two quick examples. I co-edited an Oxford series of introductory books on philosophy, or mid-level introductions to fields, and I just commissioned a Latin American philosophy book, by which I'm very excited, by a professor from the University of New Mexico. And also in my introduction to philosophy, classical and contemporary readings, which I also edit with Oxford, we've integrated some work not only from Latin America, but also Asia. And so, again, we're not yet to where we want to be, but we're making progress. I have a certain kind of hope.
And that latter volume you mentioned has had several iterations over the years,
Yes.
four or
Yes,
five,
ninth.
maybe more. And
Now we're now in the ninth edition,
oh, ninth,
and
I apologize. I think I probably
no,
started on edition three or four. I think I have seven now, but anyway,
yes, right. We're now on nine, and we're trying to put together 10. And in each volume, we've made it a point to add women's voices and voices from Asia and Latin America. Africa is an important place where we want to reach out to as well. And it's slow going, in analytic philosophy, and it should be slow going, because we want to be careful and we want to build. We don't want to do something that's not part of the conversation, but we want to keep expanding the conversation.
Yes, nicely put. So to conclude, Prof. John, I wonder if you have things you'd like to add to what we've discussed, either
Oh.
on topics we mentioned or topics we've not mentioned.
The first thing is I want to thank you, Toby, for reaching out to me, and for obviously you've taken the initiative to read much of my my work, and I really appreciate that. That's great. It's just another example of how we can collaborate across disciplines. Very appreciative. I guess I would say a couple of things. One, though I've written a lot about religion, I'm personally not a religious person. I would describe myself as an atheist, though I grew up in a Jewish family. I grew up going to religious school, having a bar mitzvah, and wondering about the Holocaust because my father's father and I don't know, three of his brothers, the brothers of my dad's father, were killed in Auschwitz, and of course the stories would percolate in my family, and I just had to wonder about how my religious views or my family's religious views fit with the reality of the Holocaust. But I'm still interested in the problem of evil and in the relationship between God and free will, and other religious questions because they're so intellectually fascinating. Religion, even though it doesn't grab me as someone who believes the basic tenets, it's culturally and intellectually central to human experience. So I have a great interest in it. The other thing is, my father was a cardiologist, and he had patients who inevitably they had cardiac events and they died. And so early in my life, I would hear stories, and it got me interested in death and what it means and what our attitudes should be. So I guess I feel, even though what I do and what almost all contemporary analytic philosophers do is somewhat abstract and theoretical, for me, it's always been an outgrowth of personal things, very deeply personal experiences or issues that I've struggled with.
John Martin Fisher, I want to thank you very much for the whole of today, but I think most especially those personal insights from your own family, which enrich my understanding of your work and will certainly add to a desire to follow up on it amongst those who may not already be familiar with that output. So it was great chatting, John. It's been too long, and so a real gift to me. I've really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you. Feeling it's mutual. And I do hope that we see each other either in beautiful California or in beautiful Barcelona.